Okay. Thank you, Jerry. So it's a distinct privilege to introduce our Lifetime Achievement Award, Dr. Mary Coleman. When I was just beginning to learn about the autism field, I was inspired by her book entitled The Neurology of Autism, in which she advanced the thesis that there are many biologically and medically medical forms of autism, types of autism, and that notion has really inspired my research throughout my career. She has been enormously productive during her career, and she has either written or edited at least 9 books, 8 of which are here, 5 of them on autism, which is an enormous accomplishment. Dr. Coleman received her bachelor's degree at the University of Chicago and then a master's degree at Johns Hopkins University in economics and political science. And then she went on to receive her medical degree at George Washington University. She did a neurology residency at the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center, and then 3 fellowships in neurology at Columbia, in pediatric neurology at Children's Hospital of D.C., and then a research-oriented special fellowship at Children's Hospital of D.C. She was on the faculty of George Washington School of Medicine, and then spent most of her career as a faculty member at Georgetown University School of Medicine. So Mary told me that she never intended to go into medical school, become a doctor, but she did because her father was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and she realized that there were no effective treatments at the time, so she decided to dedicate herself to research. And actually some of her early studies did contribute to the use of L-DOPA for the treatment of Parkinson's disease. Now, the person who really should have introduced Mary tonight is Chris Gilberg. You see that Chris has been a very long-term colleague and friend of Mary and has collaborated with her. So I reached out to Chris, who himself was a Lifetime Achievement Award either last year or the year before, and I asked him, can you capsulize it, in a few sentences Dr. Coleman? And I'm quoting now. He said that Mary's insight into autism stems from her personal brilliance, her exquisite training in neurology, particularly child neurology, her being a real doctor in the true sense of the word, her huge clinical experience in the field of autism, her systemizing talent, and not the least, the fact that she is one of the most erudite people I've ever had the privilege to know. He also said that Mary's a lover of music, apparently working on an opera, and a great historian. So, of course, Chris has enormous esteem for Dr. Coleman. And as I was going through her CV, as one does when you're trying to give an introduction, I appreciated that she's received many, many honors during her career. But in some sense, I thought not as many honors as somebody who's been so influential on the field and has had so many clinical insights should have received. And then as I dug deeper into her career, I realized that she didn't actually spend much of her time seeking out prestige and honors. But what she was really doing during her entire career was trying to develop innovative treatments for her patients, many of whom had very difficult disorders. So it's doubly rewarding, I think, that the International Society for Autism Research has chosen to acknowledge her many contributions to the field of autism research. And thus it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Mary Coleman, the 2017 INSAR Lifetime Achievement Award. Dr. Coleman.
It has been a great honor. Can you hear me? It has been a great honor to receive this award, and I want to thank the board of INSAR for their generous decision. You members of INSAR have all contributed, each of you, to our understanding of this complicated field of autism studies that has moved so far since I first entered it, and I wish to salute each of you. This includes the many outstanding research clinicians working with people with autism, the important neuropathologists, the infinitely patient educators and parents, and of course, the dedicated neuroscientists working with animals, the induced pluripotent stem cells, and other exciting new tools. The American contributions are so basic, so excellent, and they are far too numerous to mention. INSAR is also an international organization, and I want to particularly thank Christopher Gilberg of Sweden. I didn't know he was going to say something. Michele Zappella of Italy, as well as two French colleagues, Thomas Bourgeron and Catalina Bettencourt, for direct assistance with my work. And I'm here today thanks to the support of my husband, J.Y. Gronin. Slide, please. I'm a neurologist who spent my first years of practice doing metabolic studies on children with chronic forms of mental retardation, today called intellectual disabilities. Later in my practice, I began to receive referrals of intellectually disabled children who also had a diagnosis of autism. I was enchanted by the challenge of these often extraordinarily beautiful, sensitive children. For example, the handsome boy in this picture grew up to become a calendar calculator. These two categories of disability, intellectual disabilities and autism, share many characteristics, such as mostly prenatal origins and clinical presentations, usually between 18 months and 3 years. Today, we now know that there's an overlap of at least one-third of the children who have both syndromes, both autism and intellectual disability, in the same child. Unfortunately, some of these children are mute. Next slide, please. Back then, it rapidly became clear to me from my metabolic laboratory studies that the children referred to me who had been labeled as autistic had a variety of different metabolic abnormalities. So it was in 1974 that I, together with other colleagues, set up a study of 78 autistic children matched with 78 age, sex, and parent income controls. Among the many findings of this study, probably the single most important was the evidence that autism was indeed not a single disease, as was thought at the time. Rather, it appeared to be a syndrome of many different disease entities. This research study was published in 1976 as the Autistic Syndromes Plural. By now, genetic evidence has overwhelmingly confirmed this finding, that is, that the autisms are a number of etiologically distinct conditions with diverse mechanisms of action that lead to similar behavioral manifestations in the children. Just as there is no disease entity called mental retardation or intellectual disabilities, also there is no disease entity called autism or autism spectrum disorders, ASD. Both are the result of pathophysiological final common pathways inside the central nervous system that happen to lead to similar clinical presentations. So far, apparently, prenatal DNA sequence variation affecting the function of more than 100 genes has been implicated as probably relevant to the etiology of the autism at various levels of significance. As you all know, these genetic changes include single base pair mutations, as well as the copy number variations of the chromosomal abnormalities, which often encompass multiple genes, isoforms of single genes, and the regulatory elements. It is fascinating to note that often autism genes appear to converge in pathways that modulate synaptic transmission, chromatin remodeling, and transcriptional regulation. In addition, environmental risk factors, for example, maternal infections during gestation, may play a role in some of the autisms, resulting in epigenetic modifications. In those cases of external factors affecting epigenetic molecular mechanisms, we have learned that genes can be deregulated by aberrant methylation patterns of their promoters and enhancers. However, these methylmalonic mechanisms are involved in both normal and pathological brain function. We have to be careful about their interpretations. There are many common epigenetic signatures. Histone acetylome aberrations also have been found to be another epigenetic factor associated with autism, and there are now algorithms which combine histone modification and methylation data to predict which regions of the genome are most likely to contain enhancers. A useful idea, since the number of genetic variants in the genome is so enormous. And finally, to make exact diagnosis of a patient even more complex, there are even a few extremely rare cases of postnatal etiology, such as infections causing encephalitis, such as herpes simplex and malaria. These are examples. Next slide. There were many new findings in the original 1976 study. One that turned out to be quite relevant was that 22% of the children with autism were found to have hypocalcinuria, that is, too little calcium in their 24 urines, in spite of the fact of having normal serum calcium levels. An independent study by another group a decade later of a different set of children with autism again reported hypocalcinuria with normal serum calcium. In this totally separate study, 18% of the children had hypocalcinuria. The average of the two studies was 20%. Indicating that one out of every five children diagnosed as autistic at that time likely were using their kidneys to sort out calcium, not excrete the usual amount of calcium back into the urine, but to instead recycle calcium back into the blood where it can be reused by the body and, more importantly, by the brain. In other words, they were saving calcium. Clearance studies indicated perfectly normal kidney function in these studies. So the question was, why? Why were the kidneys saving calcium in this subgroup of children with autism? This could not be answered at the time, but today, with the development of the 21st century, we're beginning to find some answers. Next slide, please. Back in the 20th century, the finding that autism was a series of totally separate disease entities was a surprise to many. I've come from the study of intellectual disabilities, a field that has had a 79-year head start in identifying individual diseases. Using this model, I believe that we need to focus our time and money on studying each patient individually, time-consuming and expensive as it is, because we need to catalog all the genetic factors that contribute to the phenotype in that particular individual. Consider how these interact with one another and with his non-genetic elements. Why? There are two very important reasons. The first, and of course the most important reason for individual patient testing, is the welfare of the children and their families. It's more than just helping the families with genetic counseling, important as that is, or their chance of joining other families with children who have similar genetic mutations so they can work together for the future. Accurate individual diagnosis is basic to the children themselves, overwhelmingly vital, particularly to the children who are mute. But we have discovered something very important about the comorbidities of persons with autism, that these comorbidities are often more successfully treated by correcting the underlying error causing the disease process in the first place, even if such therapy does not change the autistic symptoms themselves. This is relevant because each individual disease has its own established comorbidities. For example, a girl with Rett syndrome cannot tell us she is having gallbladder pain. But if we know that gallbladder problems are a known comorbidity to such girls, we can make a more sophisticated guess on how to evaluate her when she is in obvious abdominal pain. Also, in order to have the hope of ever medically reversing symptoms in these children, and we do have that hope, both in individual therapies and group therapies, we need to understand exactly how mutations of genes and non-genetic elements cause the symptoms in the first place. The other main reason for individual patient testing is that autism is a series of separate disease entities. We need to identify the disturbed mechanism of action as an initial step to begin our long quest for how the social brain actually works. As of today, about 25%, possibly a bit higher, of individuals labeled as autistic have received a specific diagnosis. What that means is more than 70%, closer to 75%, do not have a meaningful diagnosis other than the general behavioral label of autistic spectrum disorder, a term better than nothing but one that remains in dispute in some quarters, including by the previous speaker. Slide 6. On the subject of comorbidities, this chart lists comorbidities of several disease entities, where a subgroup of each disease contains individuals with autistic features. We start with PKU, the first disease where children were mistakenly labeled as having Kanner's autism until their biochemistry was revealed. Thanks to the development of successful low phenylalanine diet treatment, when PKU is identified by newborn screening, we rarely see such cases today. But there are still patients alive who are not identified in time for treatment. It must be done in the first month of life, and thus they live their lives through with intellectual disability, autistic traits, and self-mutilation. However, it is now known that by placing them on the PKU diet, no matter how old they are, there is a case of a man who is 80 years old, that their disturbing self-mutilation can be completely stopped by carefully titrating the diet to exactly phenylalanine levels appropriate for them, even if other symptoms do not change. The Smith-Lemy-Opitz syndrome, where between 50 to 86% of the children meet the criteria for autism and often show syndactyly, that's the picture that shows the merging of the two toes, these children have a mutation in a gene which codes for the last step of cholesterol biosynthesis. Since dietary cholesterol was not thought to cross the blood-brain barrier, it was a surprising result when different forms of self-mutilation behavior in a significantly number of these children definitely stopped cold when they were fed cholesterol, even though the children's behavior remained otherwise handicapped. We now know that there is evidence that Smith-Lemy-Opitz syndrome may not be the only form of autism where the blood-brain barrier itself is compromised. Here you see over and over the pattern of treatment response by correcting the underlying medical error of the disease itself, duplicated in other rare disease entities. Finally, this last comorbidity on the list brings us back to the 20th century finding that one out of every five children with autism has hypocalcinuria, too little calcium in their urines, raising the question of altered calcium homeostasis in many individuals with autistic symptoms. Next slide, please. Since that original 1976 finding, a series of disease entities began to be reported where calcium levels were abnormal and many individuals were autistic. One of the very first was a quite rare one, the Timothy syndrome, a highly penetrant dominant disease where at least 70% of the children were autistic. They had flat, round faces, thin upper lips, very serious congenital cardiac defects, and the same syndactyly of fingers and toes as seen in other entities with autism. Next slide, please. Timothy syndrome is due to a mutation of the CACNA1C gene. The mutations prevent voltage inactivation of the L-alpha-1 subunit, CAV1.2, which causes the channels to open for longer periods and release excessive calcium 2+. This results in increased intracellular calcium 2+ signaling. Next, a point mutation on CACNA1F gene was found. This was found in three males of the same family who all had autism. Although it was a different mechanism and it was involving CAV1.4, nevertheless, it also resulted in excessive calcium 2+ signaling. I won't bore you with all the gene mutations so far located that contribute to voltage-gated intracellular calcium 2 signaling found in individuals with autistic features. Some are top de novo risk mutations for autism, others are poorly penetrant autism susceptibility alleles, but you can see the number has grown as more syndromes are identified. Next slide, please. This slide shows some of the activity-related signaling implicated in many diseases with autistic features. We cannot even begin to cover all the situations where calcium is involved in the brain, since it is extremely complex, both extracellular calcium and intracellular calcium. To start with, From the beginning, calcium-dependent gene expression is a factor in regulation of the early development of the brain, and its role continues throughout life. For example, both CAV1.2 and CAV1.3 require additional protein interactions for proper function and targeting, such as the well-studied SHANK proteins we have seen several interesting posters about today. The calcium ion is a critical trigger in the brain to activate many intracellular signaling pathways and regulate gene expression. One study of the calcium-dependent transcriptional repressor gene MECP2 has revealed that a mutation of the gene may be etiological to both the mute girls with Rett syndrome and also to the autism zap MECP2 syndrome of speaking girls. Meanwhile, a duplication of that MECP2 gene causes autism and stereotypic hand movements in boys who have autism in close to 100% of the cases. An important observation is that when regulatory defects altering calcium are found in persons with autism, even though each one has a separate and different complicated, often apparently contradictory mechanism of action, in the end, many of them appear to alter calcium C2+ homeostasis. There are several postmortem studies showing excess calcium in the neocortex. These studies raise the possibility that altered calcium C2+ homeostasis may play an interactive role in the cascade of signaling events leading to autistic features in at least one large significant subgroup of patients, a finding that has already been suggested by several other authors. Here are some fascinating questions in the field of autism in process of being solved, and I thought I would take today's opportunity to offer my own guesses about them. Could I have the next slide? What explains the existence of family members with endophenotypes, or form frusse, as we say in neurology, in families that have autistic probands? Also, what explains the variation in penetrance and clinical presentation of known disease entities? One likely answer, based on early studies, is the presence of other modifier genes in those family members which then contribute to the endophenotype. Regarding variation in clinical presentation, modifier genes also can be found to explain how which of the known symptoms of a disease can or cannot present clinically in any individual case. For example, whether absence of speech, ophthalmic features, or gastroesophageal reflux can be found in the phylum McDermott syndrome has been shown to directly relate to the size of the deletion in the long arm of chromosome 22 and the presence or absence of protein-coding modifier genes in that particular deletion. Next slide, please. Here's another question. Why do some genes found mutated in individuals with autism show up in studies of schizophrenia, bipolar disease, depression, and in the poster section, they also mention cancer? While, on the other hand, a single disease may have many different, completely different DNA mutations associated with it. These kinds of results have ruined many an investigator's day. Here are some guesses. In the case of completely different diseases who have mutations on exactly the same gene, it is likely that each gene may have a number of different neuroanatomical locations in the brain, and each disease on a precise location of a particular pathway. There also is the issue of the timing of when that particular gene is turned on by its promoters. In the opposite case of a single disease having mutations of many different DNAs, we already know that the longer a disease is studied, the more mutations of other DNAs tend to turn up. Perhaps each one is affecting a slightly different aspect of the dendrite, the axon, or the synapse relevant to that disease entity. Next slide. Here's another question. Why is the ratio of boys to girls in autism rather consistently 4-1? This slide shows the genes in the X chromosome. And these genes are implicated in the syndromic or non-syndromic X-linked intellectual disabilities. But the genes, as you will notice, that are highlighted in red are all genes found also in autism. In this slide, syndromic forms are on the left side, non-syndromic forms are on the right. We don't know why the ratio is four boys to one girl, particularly seen in high-functioning persons. But here is a possibility. Some studies show that up to 90% of people with autism are postulated to have some kind of underlying genetic error, and yet up to 3/4 of the individuals with autistic features do not have a genetic diagnosis, even though autism is thought to be the most genetically affected of all psychiatric diseases. Perhaps we eventually shall find that some of those cases of autism without a diagnosis may be due to non-coding mutations in the intron section of the genes of the X chromosome. From studies in adult neurology, we already know that mutations in the introns of the genes on the X chromosome, through a combination of transcription factor binding, disruption of messenger RNA translation, and altered messenger RNA stability, can result in a full presentation of a disease entity, clinically indistinguishable from a disease due to a classic DNA mutation. Could I have another slide? I wish to end this lecture with two recommendations. Number one, we should do a full workup with available resources for each individual who meets autistic criteria, even if the result is an unknown, unique mutation. In this rapidly evolving field of genetics and epigenetics, one never knows at what age that such information may become relevant to that child and that family. And finally, two, we professionals wish to thank many of the very high-functioning persons for their fight to be accepted as simply eccentric individuals as part of the full neurodiversity of fascinating human behavior, and to spur my colleagues to help them find employment, perhaps in a quiet place inside a work area, so that they can have a meaningful job with good pay, and the community can take advantage of their usually outstanding talents. Thank you.